teeth, good bones, slim, athletic, a lot of spirit. I had seen her as a plantation type, what they call a belle. I had said to myself that 150 years ago she would have been a slave owner. I began to change that opinion. I felt the crackle of toughness coming from her. She enjoyed being rich and idle, sure. Beauty parlors and lunch with the girls in Atlanta, the Bentley and the gold cards, the big kitchen which cost more than I ever made in a year. But if it came to it, here was a woman who might get down in the dirt and fight. Maybe 150 years ago, she would have been on a wagon train heading west. She had enough spirit. She looked hard at me across the table.
I panicked this morning, she said. That's not really like me at all. I must have given you a very bad impression, I'm afraid. After you left, I calmed down and thought things out. I came to the same conclusion you've just described. Hubs blundered into something, and he's got all tangled up in it. So what am I going to do about it? Well, I'm going to stop panicking and start thinking. I've been a mess since Friday, and I'm ashamed of it. That's not the real me at all. So I did something, and I hope you'll forgive me for it.
Go on, I said.
I called Dwight Stevenson, she said. He had mentioned he had seen a fax from the Pentagon about your service as a military policeman. I asked him to find it and read it to me. I thought it was an excellent record.
She smiled at me, hitched her chair in closer.
So what I want to do is to hire you, she said. I want to hire you in a private capacity to solve my husband's problem. Would you consider doing that for me?
No, I said. I can't do that, Charlie.
Can't or won't, she said.
There would be a sort of conflict of interest, I said. It might mean I couldn't do a proper job for you.
A conflict, she said. In what way?
I paused for a long moment, tried to figure out how to explain it. Your husband felt bad, okay? I said. He got hold of some kind of an investigator, a government guy, and they were trying to fix the situation. But the government guy got killed, and I'm afraid my interest is in the government guy more than your husband. She followed what I was saying and nodded.
But why?
She asked.
You don't work for the government.
The government guy was my brother, I told her. Just a crazy coincidence. I know, but I'm stuck with it. She went quiet. She saw where the conflict could lie.
I'm very sorry, she said. You're not saying Hub betrayed your brother?
No, I said. That's the very last thing he would have done. He was depending on him to get him out from under. Something went wrong, is all.
May I ask you a question? She said. Why do you refer to my husband in the past tense?
I looked straight at her. Because he's dead, I said. I'm very sorry. Charlie hung in there. She went pale and clenched her hands until her knuckles shone waxy white, but she didn't fall apart.
I don't think he's dead, she whispered. I would know. I would be able to feel it. I think he's just hiding out somewhere. I want you to find him. I'll pay you whatever you want.
I just slowly shook my head at her.
Please, she said.
I won't do it, Charlie, I said. I won't take your money for that. I would be exploiting you. I can't take your money because I know he's already dead. I'm very sorry, but there it is. There was a long silence in the kitchen. I sat there at the table, nursing the coffee she had made for me.
Would you do it if I didn't pay you? She said.
Maybe you could just look around for him while you find out about your brother? I thought about it. Couldn't see how I could say no to that. Okay, I said. I'll do that, Charlie. But like I say, don't expect miracles. I think we're looking at something very bad here.
I think he's alive, she said. I would know if he wasn't.
I started worrying about what would happen when his body was found. She was going to come face to face with reality, the same way a runaway truck comes face to face with the side of a building.
You'll need expense money,
Charlie said. I wasn't sure about taking it, but she passed me a thick envelope.
Will that do?
She asked. I looked in the envelope. There was a thick wad of $100 bills in there. I nodded. That would do.
And please, keep the car, she said. Use it as long as you need it.
I nodded again, thought about what else I needed to say, and forced myself to use the present tense. Where does he work? I asked her.
Sunrise International, she said. It's a bank.
She reeled off an Atlanta address. Okay, Charlie, I said. Now let me ask you something else. It's very important. Did your husband ever use the word pluribus? She thought about it and shrugged.
Pluribus? She said. Isn't that something to do with politics? Like on the podium when the president gives a speech? I never heard Hub talking about it. He graduated in banking studies.
You never heard him use that word, I asked her again. Not on the phone, not in his sleep, or anything?
Never,
she said. What about next Sunday? I asked her. Did he mention next Sunday? Anything about what's going to happen?
Next Sunday? She repeated. I don't think he mentioned it. Why? What's going to happen next Sunday?
I don't know, I said. That's what I'm trying to find out. She pondered it again for a long moment, but just shook her head and shrugged, palms upward, like it meant nothing to her.
I'm sorry, she said.
Don't worry about it, I said. Now you've got to do something.
What do I have to do?
She said. You've got to get out of here, I said. Her knuckles were still white, but she was staying in control.
I've got to run and hide, she said. But where to?
An FBI agent is coming here to pick you up, I said. She stared at me in panic.
FBI, she said.
She went paler still.
This is really serious, isn't it?
It's deadly serious, I said. You need to get ready to leave right now.
Okay, she said slowly. I can't believe this is happening.
I walked out of her kitchen and into the garden room where we had drunk iced tea the day before, stepped through the French doors, and strolled a slow circuit outside the house, down the driveway, through the banks of greenery, out onto Beckman Drive, leaned up on the white mailbox on the shoulder. It was silent. I could hear nothing at all except the dry rustle of the grass cooling under my feet. Then I could hear a car coming west out of town. It slowed just before the crest of the rise, and I heard the automatic box slur a change down as the speed dropped. The car rose up over the crest into view. It was a brown Buick, very plain, two guys in it. They were small, dark guys, Hispanic, loud shirts. They were slowing, drifting to the left of the road, looking for the Hubble mailbox. I was leaning on the Hubble mailbox, looking at them. Their eyes met mine. The car accelerated again and swerved away, blasted on into the empty peach country. I stepped out and watched them go. I saw a dust plume rising as they drove off Margrave's immaculate blacktop onto the dusty rural roadway. Then I sprinted back up to the house. I wanted Charlie to hurry. She was inside, flustered, chattering away like a kid going on vacation, making lists out loud, some kind of a mechanism to burn off the panic she was feeling. On Friday, she had been a rich, idle woman married to a banker. Now on Monday, a stranger who said the banker was dead was telling her to hurry up and run for her life. "Take the mobile phone with you," I called to her. She didn't reply. I just heard a worried silence, footsteps and closet doors banging. I sat in her kitchen with the rest of the coffee for most of an hour. Then I heard a car horn blow and the crunch of heavy steps on the gravel, a loud knock on the front door. I put my hand in my pocket and closed it around the ebony handle of Morrison's switchblade, walked out into the hallway, and opened up. There was a neat blue sedan next to the Bentley, and a gigantic black guy standing back from the doorstep. He was as tall as me, maybe even taller, but he must have outweighed me by at least 100 pounds. Must have been 310, 320. Next to him, I was a featherweight. He stepped forward with the easy, elastic grace of an athlete. "Rachel?" the giant said. "Pleased to meet you. I'm Picard, FBI." He shook hands with me. He was enormous. He had a casual competence about him which made me glad he was on my side. He looked like my type of a guy, like he could be very useful in a tight corner. I suddenly felt a flood of encouragement. I stood aside to let him into Charlie's house. "Okay," Picard said to me. "I got all the details from Finley. Real sorry about your brother, my friend. Real sorry. Somewhere we can talk?" I led him through to the kitchen. He loped beside me and covered the distance in a couple of strides, glanced around, and poured himself the dregs of the stewed coffee. Then he stepped over next to me and dropped his hand on my shoulder. Felt like somebody had hit me with a bag of cement. "Ground rules," he said. "This whole thing is off the record, right?" I nodded. His voice matched his bulk. It was a low rumble. It was what a brown bear would sound like if it learned to talk. I couldn't tell how old the guy was. He was one of those big, fit men whose peak years stretch on for decades. He nodded and moved away, rested his giant frame against the counter. "This is a huge problem for me," he said. "Bureau can't act without a call from the responsible official in the local jurisdiction. That would be this guy, Teal, right? And from what Finley tells me, I assume old Teal's not going to be making that call. So I could end up with my big ass in a sling for this. But I'll bend the rules for Finley. We go back quite a ways. But you got to remember, this is all unofficial, okay?" I nodded again. I was happy with that, very happy. Unofficial help suited me fine. It would get the job done without hanging me up on procedure. I had 5 clear days before Sunday. This morning, 5 days had seemed more than generous. But now, with Hubble gone, I felt like I was very short of time. Much too short of time to waste any of it on procedure. Where are you going to put them? I asked him. Safe house, up in Atlanta, Picard said. Bureau place. We've had it for years. They'll be secure there, but I'm not going to say exactly where it is, and I'm going to have to ask you not to press Mrs. Hubble about it afterward. Okay? I got to watch my back on this thing. I blow a safe house. I'm in really deep shit.
Okay, Picard, I said. I won't cause you any problems, and I appreciate it.
He nodded gravely like he was way out on a limb. Then Charlie and the kids burst in. They were burdened down with badly packed bags. Picard introduced himself. I could see that Charlie's daughter was terrified by the size of the guy. The little boy's eyes grew round as he gazed at the FBI Special Agent's shield Picard was holding out. Then the five of us carried the bags outside and piled them in the blue sedan's trunk. I shook hands with Picard and Charlie. Then they all got in the car. Picard drove them away. I waved after them. 15. I headed over to Warburton, a damn sight faster than the prison driver had, and I was there in less than 50 minutes. It was a hell of a sight. There was a storm coming in quickly from the west, and shafts of low afternoon sun were escaping the clouds and hitting the place. The glittering metal towers and turrets were catching the orange rays. I slowed up and pulled into the prison approach. Stopped outside the first vehicle cage. I wasn't going in there. I'd had enough of that. Spivey was going to have to come out to me. I got out of the Bentley and walked over to the guard. He seemed friendly enough. Spivey on duty? I asked him.
You want him? The guard said.
Tell him Mr. Reacher's here, I said. The guy ducked under a Perspex hood and made a call. Ducked back out again and shouted over to me.
He doesn't know any Mr. Reacher, he said.
Tell him Chief Morrison sent me, I said. Over from Margrave. The guy went under the Perspex thing again and started talking. After a minute, he was back out.
Okay, drive on through, he said. Spivey will meet you at reception.
Tell him he's got to come out here, I said. Meet me on the road. I walked away and stood in the dust on the edge of the blacktop. It was a battle of nerves. I was betting Spivey would come on out. I'd know in 5 minutes. I waited. I could smell rain coming out of the west. In an hour, it was going to roll right over us. I stood and waited. Spivey came out. I heard the grills on the vehicle cage grinding across. I turned and saw a dirty Ford driving through. It came out and stopped next to the Bentley. Spivey heaved himself out. He walked over. Big guy, sweating, red face and hands. His uniform was dirty.
Remember me? I asked him.
His small snake eyes flicked around. He was adrift and worried.
You're Reacher, he said. So what?
Right, I said. I'm Reacher. From Friday.
What was the deal?
He shifted from foot to foot. He was going to play hard to get. But he had already showed his hand. He'd come out to meet me. He had already lost the game. But he didn't speak.
What was the deal on Friday? I said again.
Morrison is dead, he said.
Then he shrugged and clamped his thin lips. Wouldn't say any more. I stepped casually to my left, just a foot or so, to put Spivey's bulk between me and the gate guard, so the gate guard couldn't see. Morrison's switchblade appeared in my hand. I held it up at Spivey's eye level for a second, just long enough for him to read the gold-filled engraving in the ebony. Then the blade popped out with a loud click. Spivey's small eyes were fixed on it. You think I used this on Morrison? I said. He was staring at the blade. It shone blue in the stormy sun.
It wasn't you, he said. But maybe you had good reason.
I smiled at him. He knew it wasn't me who killed Morrison. Therefore, he knew who had. Therefore, he knew who Morrison's bosses were. Simple as that. Three little words, and I was getting somewhere. I moved the blade a fraction closer to his big red face. Want me to use this on you? I said. Spivey looked around wildly, saw the gate guard 30 yards away. He's not going to help you, I said. He hates your useless fat guts. He's just a guard. You sucked ass and got promotion. He wouldn't piss on you if you were on fire. Why should he?
So what do you want?
Spivey said. Friday, I said. What was the deal?
And if I tell you?
He said. I shrugged at him. Depends what you tell me, I said. You tell me the truth, I'll let you go back inside. Want to tell me the truth? He didn't reply. We were just standing there by the road, a battle of nerves. His nerves were shot to hell, so he was losing. His little eyes were darting about. They always came back to the blade.
Okay, I'll tell you, he said. Time to time I helped Morrison out. He called me Friday, said he was sending two guys over.
Names meant nothing to me.
Never heard of you or the other guy. I was supposed to get the Hubble guy killed. That's all. Nothing was supposed to happen to you. I swear.
So what went wrong? I asked him.
My guy screwed up, he said. That's all. I swear. It was the other guy we were after. Nothing was supposed to happen to you. You got out of there, right? No damage done, right? So why give me a hard time?
I flashed the blade up real quick and nicked his chin. He froze in shock. A moment later, a fat worm of dark blood welled out of the cut.
What was the reason? I asked him. There's never a reason, he said. I just do what I'm told.
You do what you're told, I said.
I do what I'm told, he said again. I don't want to know any reasons.
So who told you what to do, I said.
Morrison, he said. Morrison told me what to do.
And who told Morrison what to do, I asked him. I held the blade an inch from his cheek. He was just about whimpering with fear. I stared into his small snake eyes. He knew the answer. I could see that, far back in those eyes. He knew who told Morrison what to do.
Who told him what to do? I asked him again. I don't know, he said. I swear, grave of my mother.
I stared at him for a long moment. Shook my head.
Wrong, Spivey, I said. You do know. You're going to tell me.
Now Spivey shook his head. His big red face jerked from side to side. The blood was running down his chin onto his slabby jowls.
They'll kill me if I do, he said.
I flicked the knife at his belly, slit his greasy shirt.
I'll kill you if you don't, I said.
Guy like Spivey, he thinks short term. If he told me, he'd die tomorrow. If he didn't tell me, he'd die today. That's how he thought, short term. So he set about telling me. His throat started working up and down like it was too dry to speak. I stared into his eyes. He couldn't get any words out. He was like a guy in a movie who crawls up a desert dune and tries to call for water. But he was going to tell me. Then he wasn't. Over his shoulder, I saw a dust plume far in the east. Then I heard the faint roar of a diesel engine. Then I made out the gray shape of the prison bus rolling in. Spivey snapped his head around to look at his salvation. The gate guard wandered out to meet the bus. Spivey snapped his head back to look at me. There was a mean gleam of triumph in his eyes. The bus was getting closer. "Who was it, Spivey?" I said. "Tell me now, or I'll come back for you." But he just backed off and turned and hustled over to his dirty Ford. The bus roared in and blew dust all over me. I closed up the switchblade and put it back in my pocket, jogged over to the Bentley, and took off. The coming storm chased me all the way back east. I felt I had more than a storm after me. I was sick with frustration. This morning I had been just one conversation away from knowing everything. Now I knew nothing. The situation had suddenly turned sour. I had no backup, no facilities, no help. I couldn't rely on Roscoe or Finley. I couldn't expect either of them to agree with my agenda. And they had troubles of their own up at the station house. What had Finley said? Working under the enemy's nose? And I couldn't expect too much from Picard. He was already way out on a limb. I couldn't count on anybody but myself. On the other hand, I had no laws to worry about, no inhibitions, no distractions. I wouldn't have to think about Miranda, probable cause, constitutional rights. I wouldn't have to think about reasonable doubt or rules of evidence. No appeal to any higher authority for these guys. Was that fair? You bet your ass. These were bad people. They had stepped over the line a long time ago. Bad people. What had Finley said? As bad as they come. And they had killed Joe Reacher. I rolled the Bentley down the slight hill to Roscoe's house, parked on the road outside her place. She wasn't home. The Chevrolet wasn't there. The big chrome clock on the Bentley's dash showed 10 of 6. 10 minutes to wait. I got out of the front seat and got into the back, stretched out on the big old car's leather bench. I wanted to get away from Margrave for the evening. I wanted to get out of Georgia altogether. I found a map in a pocket on the back of the driver's seat. I peered at it and figured if we went west for an hour, hour and a half, back past Warburton again, we'd cross the state line into Alabama. That's what I wanted to do. Blast west with Roscoe into Alabama and pull into the first live music bar we came to. Put my troubles on hold until tomorrow. Eat some cheap food, drink some cold beer, hear some dirty music with Roscoe. My idea of a hell of an evening. I settled back to wait for her. The dark was gathering in. I felt a faint chill in the evening air. About 6 o'clock, huge drops started hammering on the roof of the Bentley. It felt like a big evening thunderstorm was moving in. But it never really arrived. It never really let loose, just the big early drops spattering down like the sky was straining to unload, but wouldn't let go. It went very dark, and the heavy car rocked gently in the damp wind. Roscoe was late. The storm had been threatening for about 20 minutes before I saw her Chevy winding down the rise. Her headlights swept and arced left and right. They washed over me as she swung into her driveway. They blazed against her garage door, then died as she cut the power. I got out of the Bentley and stepped over to her. We held each other and kissed. Then we went inside.
You okay? I asked her.
I guess, she said. Hell of a day.
I nodded. It had been.
Upset? I asked her.
She was moving around, switching lamps on, pulling drapes.
This morning was the worst thing I've ever seen, she said. By far the worst thing. But I'm going to tell you something I would never tell anyone else. I wasn't upset. Not about Morrison. You can't get upset about a guy like that. But I'm upset about his wife. Bad enough living with a guy like Morrison without dying because of him, too, right?
What about the rest of it? I asked her. Teal?
I'm not surprised, she said. That whole family has been scum for 200 years. I know all about them. His family and my family go way back together. Why should he be any different? But, God, I'm glad everybody else in the department turned out clean. I was dreading finding out one of those guys had been in it, too. I don't know if I could have faced that.
She went into the kitchen, and I followed. She went quiet. She wasn't falling apart, but she wasn't happy. She pulled open the refrigerator door. It was a gesture which said, "The cupboard is bare." She smiled a tired smile at me.
"You want to buy me dinner?"
she said. "Sure," I said. "But not here. In Alabama." I told her what I wanted to do. She liked the plan. She brightened up and went to take a shower. I figured I could use a shower, too, so I went with her. But we hit a delay because as soon as she started to unbutton her crisp uniform shirt, my priorities shifted. The lure of an Alabama bar receded, and the shower could wait, too. She was wearing black underwear beneath the uniform. Not very substantial items. We ended up in a frenzy on the bedroom floor. The thunderstorm was finally breaking outside. The rain was lashing the little house. Lightning was blazing, and the thunder was crashing about. We finally made it to the shower. By then, we really needed it. Afterward, I lay on the bed while Roscoe dressed. She put on faded denims and a silky shirt. We turned off the lamps again and locked up and took off in the Bentley. It was 7:30, and the storm was drifting off to the east, heading for Charleston before boiling out over the Atlantic. Might hit Bermuda tomorrow. We headed west toward a pinker sky. I found the road back out to Warburton, cruised down the farm roads between the endless dark fields, and blasted past the prison. It squatted, glowering in its ghastly yellow light. A half hour after Warburton, we stopped to fill the old car's gigantic tank, threaded through some tobacco country, and crossed the Chattahoochee by an old river bridge in Franklin, then a sprint down to the state line. We were in Alabama before 9 o'clock. We agreed to take a chance and stop at the first bar. We saw an old roadhouse maybe a mile later, pulled into the parking lot and got out. Looked okay. Big enough place. Wide and low, built from tarred boards. Plenty of neon, plenty of cars in the lot. And I could hear music. The sign at the door said, "The Pond. Live music 7 nights a week at 9:30. Roscoe and I held hands and walked in. We were hit by bar noise and jukebox music and a blast of beery air. We pushed through to the back and found a wide ring of booths around a dance floor with a stage beyond. The stage was really just a low concrete platform. It might once have been some kind of a loading bay. The ceiling was low and the light was dim. We found an empty booth and slid in. watched the band setting up while we waited for service. The waitresses were rushing around like basketball centers. One dived over, and we ordered beers, cheeseburgers, fries, onion rings. Pretty much right away, she ran back with a tin tray with our stuff on it. We ate and drank and ordered more.
"So what are you going to do about Joe?"
Roscoe asked me. I was going to finish his business, whatever it was, whatever it took. That was the decision I had made in her warm bed that morning. But she was a police officer. She was sworn to uphold all kinds of laws, laws that were designed to get in my way. I didn't know what to say, but she didn't wait for me to say anything.
"I think you should find out who it was killed him," she said.
"And then what?" I asked her. But that was as far as we got. The band started up. We couldn't talk anymore. Roscoe gave an apologetic smile and shook her head. The band was loud. She shrugged, saying sorry for the fact that I couldn't hear her talking. She sketched me a tell-you-later gesture across the table, and we turned to face the stage. I wished I could have heard her reply to my question. The bar was called The Pond, and the band was called Pond Life. They started pretty well. A classic trio, guitar, bass, drums, firmly into the Stevie Ray Vaughan thing. Since Stevie Ray died in his helicopter up near Chicago, it seemed like you could count up all the white men under 40 in the southern states, divide by 3, and that was the number of Stevie Ray Vaughan tribute bands. Everybody was doing it, because it didn't require much. Didn't matter what you looked like, didn't matter what gear you had. All you needed was to get your head down and play. The best of them could match Stevie Ray's on-a-dime changes from loose bar rock to the old Texas blues. This lot was pretty good. Pond Life. They lived up to their ironic name. The bass and the drums were big, messy guys, lots of hair all over, fat and dirty. The guitar player was a small, dark guy, not unlike old Stevie Ray himself. The same gappy grin. He could play, too. He had a black Les Paul copy and a big Marshall stack. Good old-fashioned sound. The loose, heavy strings and the big pickups overloading the ancient Marshall tubes, giving that glorious, fat, buzzy scream you couldn't get any other way. We were having a good time. We drank a lot of beer, sat tight together in the booth. Then we danced for a while. Couldn't resist it. The band played on and on. The room got hot and crowded. The music got louder and faster. The waitresses sprinted back and forth with long-neck bottles. Roscoe looked great. Her silky shirt was damp. She wasn't wearing anything underneath it. I could see that because of the way the damp silk stuck to her skin. I was in heaven. I was in a plain old bar with a stunning woman and a decent band. Joe was on hold until tomorrow. Margrave was a million miles away. I had no problems. I didn't want the evening to end. The band played on until pretty late. Must have been way past midnight. We were juiced up and sloppy. Couldn't face the drive back. It was raining again, lightly. Didn't want to drive an hour and a half in the rain. Not so full of beer. Might end up in a ditch or in jail. There was a sign to a motel a mile further on. Roscoe said we should go there. She was giggly about it, like we were eloping or something, like I had transported her across the state line for that exact purpose. I hadn't, specifically, but I wasn't about to put up a whole lot of objections. So we stumbled out of the bar with ringing ears and got into the Bentley. We rolled the big old car cautiously and slowly down the streaming road for a mile. Saw the motel up ahead, a long, low old place like something out of a movie. I pulled into the lot and went into the office, roused the night guy at the desk, gave him the money and arranged an early morning call, got the key and went back out to the car. I pulled it around to our cabin and we went in. It was a decent, anonymous place. Could have been anywhere in America, but it felt warm and snug with the rain pattering on the roof, and it had a big bed. I didn't want Roscoe to catch a chill. She ought to get out of that damp shirt. That's what I told her. She giggled at me, said she hadn't realized I had medical qualifications. I told her we had been taught enough for basic emergencies.
Is this a basic emergency?
She giggled.
It will be soon, I laughed, if you don't take that shirt off.
So she did take it off. Then I was all over her. She was so beautiful, so provocative. She was ready for anything. Afterward, we lay in an exhausted tangle and talked about who we were, about what we had done, about who we wanted to be, and what we wanted to do. She told me about her family. It was a bad luck story stretching back generations. They sounded like decent people, farmers, people who had nearly made it but never did. People who had struggled through the hard times before chemicals, before machinery, hostages to the power of nature. Some old ancestor had nearly made it big, but he lost his best land when Mayor Teal's great-grandfather built the railroad. Then some mortgages were called in, and the grudge rolled on down the years so that now she loved Margrave, but hated to see Teal walking around like he owned it, which he did, and which Teal's always had. I talked to her about Joe. I told her things I had never told anybody else, all the stuff I had kept to myself, all about my feelings for him, and why I felt driven to do something about his death, and how I was happy to do it. We went through a lot of personal stuff, talked for a long time, and fell asleep in each other's arms. Seemed like more or less straight away the guy was banging on the door with the early morning call. Tuesday. We got up and staggered around. The early sun was struggling against a damp dawn. Within 5 minutes we were back in the Bentley rolling east. The rising sun was blinding on the dewy windshield. Slowly we woke up. We crossed the state line back into Georgia, crossed the river in Franklin, settled into a fast cruise through the empty farming country. The fields were hidden under a floating quilt of morning mist. It hung over the red earth like steam. The sun climbed up and set about burning it off. Neither of us spoke. We wanted to preserve the quiet, intimate cocoon as long as possible. Arriving back in Margrave was going to burst the bubble soon enough. So I guided the big stately car down the country roads and hoped. Hoped there'd be plenty more nights like that one and quiet mornings like this one. Roscoe was curled up on the big hide chair beside me, lost in thought. She looked very content. I hoped she was. We blasted past Warburton again. The prison floated like an alien city on the carpet of low mist. We passed the little copse I'd seen from the prison bus, passed the rows of bushes invisible in the fields, reached the junction and turned south onto the county road, past Eno's diner and the station house and the firehouse, down onto Main Street. We turned left at the statue of the man who took good land for the railroad, down the slope to Roscoe's place. I parked at the curb, and we got out, yawning and stretching. We grinned briefly at each other. We had had fun. We walked hand in hand down the driveway. Her door was open. Not wide open, but an inch or two ajar. It was ajar because the lock was smashed. Someone had used a crowbar on it. The tangle of broken lock and splinters wouldn't allow the door to close all the way. Roscoe put her hand to her mouth and gave a silent gasp. Her eyes were wide. They slid from the door to me. I grabbed her elbow and pulled her away. We stood flat against the garage door, crouched down, stuck close to the walls, and circled right around the house. Listened hard at every window, and risked ducking our heads up for a quick glance into every room. We arrived back at the smashed front door. We were wet from kneeling on the soaked ground and from brushing against the dripping evergreens. We stood up, looked at each other and shrugged, pushed the door open, and went inside. We checked everywhere. There was nobody in the house. No damage, no disturbance. Nothing was stolen. The stereo was still there, the TV was still there. Roscoe checked her closet. The police revolver was still on her belt. She checked her drawers and her bureau. Nothing had been touched. Nothing had been searched. Nothing was missing. We stood back in the hallway and looked at each other. Then I noticed something that had been left behind. The low morning sun was coming in through the open door and playing a shallow beam over the floor. I could see a line of footprints on the parquet. A lot of footprints. Several people had tracked through from the front door into the living room. The line of prints disappeared on the bold living room rug, reappeared on the wood floor leading into the bedroom, came back out through the living room, back to the front door. They had been made by people coming in from the rainy night. A slight film of muddy rainwater had dried on the wood, leaving faint prints. Faint, but perfect. I could see at least four people, in and out. I could see the tread patterns they had left behind. They had been wearing rubber overshoes, like you get for the winter, up north.
16. They had come for us in the night. They had come expecting a lot of blood. They had come with all their gear, their rubber overshoes and their nylon body suits, their knives, their hammer, their bag of nails. They had come to do a job on us, like they'd done on Morrison and his wife. They had pushed open the forbidden door. They had made a second fatal mistake. Now they were dead men. I was going to hunt them down and smile at them as they died. Because to attack me was a second attack on Joe. He was no longer here to stand up for me. It was a second challenge, a second humiliation. This wasn't about self-defense. This was about honoring Joe's memory. Roscoe was following the trail of footprints, showing a classic reaction. Denial. Four men had come to butcher her in the night. She knew that, but she was ignoring it, closing it out of her mind, dealing with it by not dealing with it. Not a bad approach, but she'd fall off the high wire before long. Until then, she was making herself busy tracing the faint footprints on her floors. They had searched the house for us. They had split up in the bedroom and looked around. Then they had regrouped in the bedroom and left. We looked for tracks outside on the road, but there was nothing. The smooth tarmac was wet and steaming. We went back inside. No evidence at all except the wrenched lock and the faint footprints throughout the house. Neither of us spoke. I was burning with anger, still watching Roscoe, waiting for the dam to break. She had seen the Morrison corpses. I hadn't. Finley had sketched in the details for me.
That was bad enough. He'd been there. He'd been shaken by the whole thing. Roscoe had been there, too. She'd seen exactly what somebody wanted to do to the two of us.
So, who were they after?
She said at last.
Me? You? Both of us?
They were after both of us, I said. They figure Hubble talked to me in prison. They figure I've told you all about it. So they think you and I know whatever it was Hubble knew. She nodded, vaguely. Then she moved away and leaned up near her back door, looking out at her neat evergreen garden. I saw her go pale. She shuddered. The defenses crashed down. She pressed herself into the corner by the door, tried to flatten herself onto the wall, stared into space like she was seeing all the nameless horrors, started crying like her heart was broken. I stepped over and held her tight, pressed her against me and held her as she cried out the fear and the tension. She cried for a long time. She felt hot and weak. My shirt was soaked with her tears.
"Thank God we weren't here last night," she whispered.
I knew I had to sound confident. Fear wouldn't get her anywhere. Fear would just sap her energy. She had to face it down. And she had to face down the dark and the quiet again tonight, and every other night of her life. "I wish we had been here," I said. "We could have gotten a few answers." She looked at me like I was crazy, shook her head.
"What would you have done?" she said. "Killed four men?"
"Only three," I said. "The fourth would have given us the answers." I said it with total certainty, total conviction, like absolutely no other possibility existed. She looked at me. I wanted her to see this huge guy, a soldier for 13 long years, a bare-knuckle killer, icy blue eyes. I was giving it everything I had. I was willing myself to project all the invincibility, all the implacability, all the protection I felt. I was doing the hard, no-blink stare that used to shrivel up drunken Marines two at a time. I wanted Roscoe to feel safe. After what she was giving me, I wanted to give her that. I didn't want her to feel afraid. "It's going to take more than four little country boys to get me," I said. "Who are they kidding? I've shit better opponents than that. They come in here again, they'll go out in a bucket. And I'll tell you what, Roscoe, someone even thinks about hurting you, they die before they finish thinking." It was working. I was convincing her. I needed her to be bright, tough, self-confident. I was willing her to pick it up. It was working. Her amazing eyes were filling with spirit. "I mean it, Roscoe," I said. "Stick with me and you'll be okay." She looked at me again, pushed her hair back.
"Promise?" she said.
"You got it, babe," I said. Held my breath. She sighed a ragged sigh, pushed off the wall and stepped over. Tried a brave smile. The crisis was gone. She was up and running. "Now we get the hell out of here," I said. "We can't stay around like sitting targets, so throw what you need into a bag."
"Okay," she said. "Are we going to fix my door first?"
I thought about her question. It was an important tactical issue. "No," I said. "If we fix it, it means we've seen it. If we've seen it, it means we know we're under attack. Better if they figure we don't know we're under attack, because then they'll figure they don't need to be too careful next time. So we don't react at all. We make out we haven't been back here. We make out we haven't seen the door. We carry on, acting dumb and innocent. If they think we're dumb and innocent, they'll get careless. Easier to spot them coming next time."
"Okay," she said.
She didn't sound convinced, but she was agreeing. "So throw what you need into a bag," I said again. She wasn't happy, but she went off to gather up some stuff. The game was starting. I didn't know exactly who the other players were. I didn't even know exactly what the game was, but I knew how to play. Opening move was I wanted them to feel like we were always one step behind.
Should I go to work today?
Roscoe asked. Got to, I said. Can't do anything different from normal. And we need to speak with Finley. He's expecting the call from Washington. And we need what we can get on Sherman's staller. But don't worry, they're not going to gun us down in the middle of the squad room. They'll go for somewhere quiet and isolated, probably at night. Teal's the only bad guy up there, so just don't be on your own with him. Stick around Finlay or Baker or Stevenson, okay? She nodded, went to get showered and dressed for work. Within 20 minutes she came out of the bedroom in her uniform, patted herself down, ready for the day. She looked at me.
Promise?
She said. The way she said it was like a question, an apology, a reassurance, all in one word. I looked back at her. You bet your ass, I said, and winked. She nodded, winked back. We were okay. We went out the front door and left it slightly open, just like we had found it. I hid the Bentley in her garage to maintain the illusion that we hadn't been back to her house. Then we got in her Chevy and decided to start with breakfast up at Eno's. She took off and gunned the car up the hill. It felt loose and low after the upright old Bentley. Coming down the hill toward us was a panel van, smart, dark green, very clean, brand new. It looked like a utility van, but on the side was a sign in fancy gold script. It said, Kleiner Foundation, same as I'd seen the gardeners using. What's that truck? I said to Roscoe. She wafted through the right at the convenience store, up on the main street.
Foundation's got a lot of trucks, she said.
What is it they do? I asked her.
Big deal around here, she said. Old man Kleiner. The town sold him the land for his warehouses, and part of the deal was he set up a community program. Teal runs it out of the mayor's office.
Teal runs it, I said. Teal's the enemy.
He runs it because he's the mayor, she said, not because he's Teal. The program assigns a lot of money, spends it on public things. Roads, gardens, the library, local business grants. Gives the police department a hell of a lot. Gives me a mortgage subsidy just because I'm with the department.
Gives Teal a lot of power, I said. And what's the story with the Kleiner boy? He tried to warn me off you, made out he had a prior claim.
She shuddered. He's a jerk, she said. I avoid him when I can. You should do the same.
She drove on, looking edgy, kept glancing around, startled, like she felt under threat, like someone was going to jump out in front of the car and gun us down. Her quiet life in the Georgia countryside was over. 4 men in the night up at her house had shattered that. We pulled into Eno's gravel lot, and the big Chevy rocked gently on its soft springs. I slid out of the low seat, then we crunched across the gravel together to Eno's door. It was a gray day. The night rain had chilled the air and left rags of cloud all over the sky. The siding on the diner reflected the dullness. It was cold. It felt like a new season. We went in. The place was empty. We took a booth, and the woman with glasses brought us coffee. We ordered eggs and bacon with all kinds of extras on the side. A black pickup was pulling into the lot outside. Same black pickup as I'd seen 3 times before. Different driver. Not the Kleiner kid. This was an older guy, maybe approaching 60, but bone hard and lean. iron gray hair shaved close to his scalp. He was dressed like a rancher in denim, looked like he lived outdoors in the sun. Even through Eno's window, I could